You're listening to AM 970, The Answer. And now, Reaching Out with Gregory Floyd, the president of Teamsters Local 237.
Welcome to another edition of Reaching Out. I'm Gregory Floyd, president, Local 237 Teamsters. With us, our very special guest is Councilman Ben Carlos. He was elected in 2013 to represent the Upper East Side, Mid-East, Roosevelt Island, and East Harlem. He grew up in the Upper East Side. Grandparents who fled anti-Semitism in Europe, a former vice chair of the Jewish Caucus. Councilman, welcome to Reaching Out.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for all that you do for your members.
Thank you. And before we begin, because I know we have a list of questions here, but something just recently came up that I thought about when I read that your grandparents fled anti-Semitism in Europe, and now they're here. Would you ever think that what your grandparents fled decades ago would be a topic of the current events now? At least three or four synagogues have been attacked. And
most recently, killed? Actually, yeah. This past weekend. Hate is not going away. It is something we have to fight in every generation. Prior to World War II, my family had to flee Europe because of anti-Semitism. My wife immigrated to the United States from the Soviet Union because of anti-Semitism there. This country has welcomed my family twice as refugees from anti-Semitism. And the big issue here is we have somebody in the White House who is welcoming hate, is spouting hate, and we as a country need to stand up to hate, welcome immigrants, no matter what their race, religion, or creed, from whichever country they may come, because ultimately this country is here for refugees. That's what the lady in the harbor, the Statue of Liberty, says. And New York City is a sanctuary city, so my arms are open, my district's arms are open, and our city's arms are open, and we will stand up to hate anytime we see it, regardless of where we see it.
Yeah, I just had to mention that, reading your bio and your grandparents and now your wife fleeing other countries to come here because of anti-Semitism. Last year, New Yorkers voted to amend the city charter. Talk about what that has meant for New Yorkers.
The city charter is the constitution for the city of New York, and it's when something goes in there, it usually can only be changed by another vote. Something that went to the ballot was actually term limits. And as folks got to see, the politicians tried to get away with a third term. And at the time, the mayor got away with it. But now it's two terms of 4 years. One of the concerns that I've always had as a New Yorker is that sometimes the city government doesn't do what I want it to do. And the politicians that lead the city government will do something I disagree with. And we can disagree from time to time, but when I see somebody do something I disagree with, and then they take $5,000, $100, $10,000, $20,000, hundreds of thousands of dollars from a real estate developer on the other side who wants to tear down my community, force everybody out who, because they can't afford it, and replace us all with millionaires and billionaires. I don't want to live in that city. I want to live in this city, in New York City. And what I wanted to see was less big money in city politics. So I testified at the Charter Revision Commission, and they adopted a lot of the ideas that I proposed. And so question one on the ballot was about getting big money out of politics. Now, it's possible some of your listeners may have fallen asleep while I just talked about this, but for me, I think it's the number one issue. And a lot of people told me no one cared. But when people turned out to vote, 1.4 million people turned over the ballot, and 1.1 million people voted to get big money out of politics. That was 80% of the vote, And more people voted to get big money out of politics than voted for the mayor on the Democrat or Republican lines combined. That tells me that liberal or conservative, you want to get big money out of politics and you want politicians who work for you, not just big money.
Now, when you say big money, what is the ramifications of that now? What is the dollar amount? One entity, big money, corporation, person, what's the dollar amount they could give to a campaign?
Previously, any person in New York City could give $5,100. Now, I'll be honest, I don't know very many people who have $5,100 to give, and I don't know anyone who can give that much without expecting something in return. I once got a piece of jewelry for somebody. It wasn't really worth that much, but it was worth a lot to me, and I expected that person to spend the rest of her life with me. She said, yes, our daughter is 14 months old, but the point is that it's $5,100. We voted to lower that to $2,000. That's still too much money, but the key thing that we did is we said for the first $250 that any resident gives, it would get matched 8 times. And what we ended up seeing is this one of my colleagues named Jemani Williams ran for public advocate.
Yes.
He's the first person to run citywide and say he wasn't going to take any money from real estate. He didn't take any money from real estate. He won. And when we looked at the numbers afterwards, in 2013, 73% of the money was big money. And in this last election, 63% of the money was $250 or less. And it changed how the election works.
Sure. And, you know, it did help him that he ran for lieutenant governor. He had name recognition, had a good showing there. And I thought he might be the front runner in this election because of his previous election. So he was a good attractive candidate for this office.
I've always looked up to Jemani Williams. At a time that police officers were stopping and frisking people of color in our city and actually stopped more people of color than lived in our city, it was a practice that I thought needed to end. When I ran in 2013, this was a controversial position. Jemani Williams put his life and his body on the line. And if you are a person who was a victim of stop and frisk, I feel that you already knew Jemani Williams.
Yes.
And I'll tell you, anytime I walk around the city with him, whether he was a council member, lieutenant governor candidate, or currently the public advocate, folks know Jemani Williams as somebody who will stand up for you and your community. That's actually why I had right. endorsed him. I was actually the first person in Manhattan to do so, and we're so lucky to have him. He's a real person.
Now, I have to ask you a question. He is a real person. You mentioned big donors, big money, getting things in return. When you were making that phrase, I know who came to my mind, but I don't know if you were referring to anybody specific or you were just saying generally.
I'm a Democrat, but I'll say something nice about Donald Trump. When he was running for president of the United States of America at the Republican debate, he said that anytime a politician called, he gave them money. And when he called them, they always picked up the phone and they did what he needed. And that level of honesty mm-hmm. shows exactly what's wrong. And honestly, there are other politicians who have that problem. But the goal is to get that money out. Government may still not do everything you want, but at least you won't be wondering whether it's because they took a lot of money from somebody.
Well, we have a question here. It says, we hear a lot about NYCHA privatization happening in your district, and that's a topic that affects your residents. Now, I know, and I say follow the money. I know the real estate developers have made proposals to the city, and they have been granted land access. Like it was, people used to say that Mayor Bloomberg gave the city away the real estate. I could say that has tripled under this current administration, and I'm watching it. And yeah, I'm a Democrat, and I'm an honest person. And I know when I see someone getting a return on their dollar, and it doesn't look like anybody that has donated in that campaign hasn't gotten a return on their dollar.
And I think what you're referring to is at public housing in my district at a building called Holmes Towers. A developer has proposed to build a skyscraper more than 500 feet tall on a playground where children grew up playing, families have raised their children, sandwiched in between two towers. And they're hoping to actually override the law so that the buildings can be closer together. And then they want to put more poor people on the bottom of the building so that they can sell better views to wealthy people. And they're going to have half the building for ultra wealthy luxury, and then the other half for low income New Yorkers. And so when they had made this proposal, I was very concerned about privatizing our public housing land. In particular, I wanted to make sure that we're taking care of our existing properties. And so this property had an appraisal of $60 million, but the city only got $26 million. And the two buildings next door needed more than $30 million in repairs. So the city didn't even get enough money to do the repairs. We got less than half of what we were asking for. And I'm concerned it's not a good deal. I don't think it's the right location. The building will literally cast a shadow over low-income residents of color in public housing. And what I had actually said is, if you're going to build on public housing, it should be a location that the residents want. It should be something where the residents get to move into the new building. You shouldn't take somebody's backyard, put up a luxury building in it, and then make them watch luxury people move in. They should get to move into that, take their old building, fix it up. And I think the last piece was just, I think that the building needs to be 100% affordable. We have more than 60,000 people who woke up this morning in a shelter. 23,000 of them were children. And I can't abide building luxury housing at this on public housing land at the same time as we have children waking up in a homeless shelter.
What you just said can go even further, because once you build that nice skyscraper, you knock down the other buildings around and build more. Because at Fulton Houses, the proposal is to knock down Fulton Houses and build there. I remember Scott Stringer did an audit, and he identified over 1,000 lots that were owned by the city. Why can't the developers go there and build?
I was actually chair of the Land Use Committee on Planning Dispositions and Concessions, which actually specializes on taking city land, giving it to developers to build affordable housing. And what I'll say is, I was very concerned about what I was seeing. First, I was concerned that we were giving land away, we were giving developers hundreds of millions of dollars in tax breaks, and they were building quote-unquote affordable housing, but some of it was for people making $199,000 a year. And sometimes the rents exceeded what the market was in the neighborhoods, which meant that we were paying tax dollars, giving away city land to gentrify low-income communities of color. I was also concerned about the fact that the work that we were doing wasn't going to minority and women-owned businesses, even though they were supposed to be going. And I think a big issue for me was about the jobs. There's a local hire requirement on a lot of these jobs. And I wanted anyone watching the hearings to be able to dial the number and call a developer and get a job in the community. But the biggest concern for me, and this is as a union side labor lawyer and as just somebody who has to live here, is a lot of the developers were paying quote unquote a living wage, which was their lingo for a minimum wage, which is $15 an hour, which is max $27,000, $28,000 a year, which pushes people at the 30% AMI. And when you're really building this affordable, when you're building the so-called affordable housing for people making $200,000 a year, you're actually making the problem worse. And that's why I've actually introduced legislation that says, if you're taking city money, you should pay people enough wages and benefits so that they don't need the affordable housing they're building.
Wow, that's quite a stance. You're listening to Reaching Out. I'm Gregory Floyd, President, Local 237. Teamsters, with me, a very special guest is Councilman Ben Gallos. You know, I love everything you're saying. You should be on more often because people should hear your views, because I can tell you, you have a bright future because you are a champion for the people. And I don't say that about many people, but I say that about you. I say that about Jumaane. But now I see why you and Jumaane were close and he took you around, because you're cut from the same cloth. You were also the chair of the Subcommittee on Planning, Dispositions, and Concessions for 18 months. Tell us about your work there.
So I think I already touched on a little bit of the affordability issues, the job issues. One thing I think I just want to take a separate aside just to touch base on is there's this program in the city called third party transfer. And it's very controversial because what the city was doing was they were taking property that people owned and they were taking it away from them and then giving it to real estate developers. And this has caught a lot of attention in low-income communities of color because some of these buildings were people who had abandoned their property. And those people deserve to lose their property. But in some of these cases, in one or two of them, the folks actually lived in the building. And some of them were in something called an HDFC co-op, which means the building was abandoned, the tenants got together with the city, and they took over the building. And they started fixing it up. And then for whatever reason, they missed a tax payment here, or they didn't get the water bill there. And now the city was taking their property from people who were co-op owners who owned their building, and they were giving it to a developer. And so I blew the whistle on it. We've reformed the program. And actually, I've been able to make sure that more HDFCs are getting their taxes forgiven and people are getting to stay owners of their building. Ultimately, what I would say is in my time in that committee, we did over 6,000 units of affordable housing that were either preserved or constructed. And I'll continue fighting to make sure that that work is done by MWBEs and that people get paid a prevailing wage to do that work.
And that was done under this current administration. They found a loophole and they found more land and buildings to give to real estate developers.
That's correct.
Now, I want to tell you how it was done, how they missed the water bill and the taxes. My mother lives in Queens. When she paid off the mortgage, it was my grandmother, my father, my mother. My mother's the last one of the three when we originally moved there 44 years ago. The bank paid all the taxes because of escrow and everything. They took care of all of the paperwork. My mother found out that they were going to foreclose on two lots because the house sat on three lots. We didn't know this. Mm-hmm. Because you buy the house, you're there, you're living in it. You don't know. We knew we had a lot of property. We didn't know it was three separate lots. You had to pay taxes on three separate lots. But my mother had the money to pay off the back taxes on both the second and third lot. So fortunately, they didn't come and take those lots from my mother, but because she had the money. And then we realized, and she told me, Greg, we have three lots. You got to pay taxes on all three plus the house. I got it. But the average person wouldn't know that because the bank usually takes care of everything. And because it was foreclosed and the tenants took it over, they didn't know that. No one ever told them about the taxes, the water bill. So now in hearing that story, I know how easily it could be done.
And I had heard that story myself where people paid taxes on one or two lots and no one ever told them, hey, there's one other. And so that exactly happened. And what I would say is, no one had taken that level of attention to detail to the committee because it had previously kind of just been a rubber stamp committee, but we decided to actually do some work with the committee and we uncovered a lot of these stories, and thankfully we've been able to help a lot of homeowners.
Very good, very good. Listen, more you talk, the more I like. And you know what, this fourth subject is really going to be big for the union members who are listening. You are a big supporter of unions and the labor movement and your prevailing wage legislation. Tell us about your prevailing wage legislation.
So comes back to my experience over the past 18 months and seeing real estate developers getting free land and hundreds of millions of dollars from the city in tax abatements. and wondering why we couldn't afford to pay our workers better. And at the same time, I introduced legislation that became a law that's keeping track of everyone who's getting injured. And it still happens, people dying on construction sites every single day. And there's, if the mayor can do Vision Zero for traffic collisions, I don't know why we can't do the same thing for construction safety. And so in construction, there's two things that you can have that can keep you safe on a job site. And it's representation and it's apprenticeship, which means you get training. Your first day on the construction site, you're not being asked to do something on your own. You're there with somebody who has a lot more experience than you. You get training from a training hall that comes out of your dues. And so you're coming on with the education you need to be safe, and you're surrounded by other people who are safe. And then making sure people are getting prevailing wage, which comes with health benefits. People on construction sites don't have health insurance. They get hurt, they end up in the hospital. It's everyone's tax dollars that ends up paying for it because they end up being uninsured.
That's right.
And then they end up going bankrupt. If somebody gets disabled on a job site, if they don't have disability through a labor union, it's again your tax dollars that are going to go into paying for that person's disability. And similarly, unless you're in a labor union, you're likely not going to be getting retirement. And when somebody works 30 years on a job site doing different sites, so all these things were a concern for me because there's these construction companies who are offloading all these costs onto taxpayers, versus if you're dealing with a labor union, a lot of those folks are actually going to have the benefits they need, and the taxpayers don't have to pay any of it. So I've introduced legislation to require prevailing wage, and what that means is just that the people on the site shouldn't be getting paid minimum wage. They should be getting benefits. And what they do is they compare a person who's doing work. So if they're a truck driver taking things back and forth from the construction site, they're going to be compared to every truck driver in the region to make sure they're getting paid the same rate. Those rates are actually set by the comptroller every couple of years. Yes. And so that's one piece. And then the apprenticeship just means that we're going to educate people, invest in them, so that somebody can start on a job site and maybe they'll be making closer to the minimum wage, but they'll have those benefits. But as they put in their time, they're going to become a master and they're going to get paid very well for their time. And they're going to be able to retire and live in the city with their family. And they're not going to need the affordable housing that we're building.
Okay. We have 2 minutes. I'm going to pick one topic. We got 2 minutes, and I'm going to pick this because I think this is near and dear to both of us. The fight to expand the access of school food. Where do things stand with that universal breakfast and dinner, lunch and dinner? Because this could be the only meal that our children receive throughout the day.
I was one of those kids. I grew up in an intergenerational home with my grandparents and my mother, single mom. I was on free and reduced school lunch. I'll be honest, I was going to get teased over it, so I was afraid to use it. And too many kids do. And so I always got to school too late for breakfast, and I always ended up skipping lunch. So if I was having dinner that night, that was it. It's a sad story that too many kids are making these bad decisions that I made too. That's why I wanted Mayor de Blasio to keep his promise from 2013 for a free school lunch for every kid. And so every single kid in New York City, 1.1 million public school children, is getting breakfast after the bell. They're also getting a free lunch, and they're getting a free salad bar. So all of that is happening. We're accounting for two meals. And the next thing I'm focused on is making sure that we can get supper into every single school in our city so that we know that kids can grow up from 3 to 18 with 3 square meals a day.
It sounds good. Listen, anything I could do to help you, because we represent the food service managers in the schools, so that is a topic that's dear to my heart. And as a matter of fact, they need more of the food service, more food service personnel, because they're stressed because of the activity and the meals that they have to serve.
It's a good problem to have. Thank you to your members for serving our 1.1 million kids every day.
This is Reaching Out. I'm Gregory Floyd, President, Local 237. A very special guest, Councilman Ben Carlos.
Thanks for listening to Reaching Out with Gregory Floyd, president of Teamsters Local 237. Join us each and every Saturday night at 7, right here on AM 970, The Answer.